This episode is brought to you by Heritage Foods, an online and wholesale distributor of heritage breed meat and poultry. Learn more at heritagefoods.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. This week, we're looking at the way labels shape our perspectives on food.
I know you're not supposed to judge a book by its cover, but is it acceptable to judge a wine by its label?
There are some labels that I'd say are so bad they're good.
As long as your paperwork's in good shape, you'll get a grass-fed label.
Tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network. That's Meat plus sign THREE. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to The Line. I'm your host, Eli Sussman, co-owner of Samisa Restaurant at Enebev Restaurants in Brooklyn, New York. And we're coming to you live from the Heritage Radio Network studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn, in the back of Roberta's. Did you vote yet? Please go vote today. If you're listening live, there's plenty of time before the polls close. The rain is dying down. You should get out there and you should vote. Today, my guest is chef owner Greg Backstrom. He owns the wildly popular Olmsted restaurant located in Brooklyn. He's worked at Alinea, Blue Hill, Per Se, and overseas in Norway. And he also worked as a private chef before opening his first restaurant in Prospect Heights in spring of 2016. The restaurant has won quite a few awards. It has been named one of Esquire's best new restaurants in America, Bon Appetit's 50 best new restaurants in America, Food & Wine's 2017 Restaurant of the Year, a New York Times 10 Best in 2016, and a New York Times Magazine Where to Eat in 2017. Today we're going to talk about his early career cooking with Grant Achatz and also Dan Barber, and of course transitioning into leading his own restaurant here in Brooklyn. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thanks, man.
So you've had a good couple of years run here at Olmsted. How are you feeling right now about the restaurant? Does it feel like the restaurant is where you want it to be? You're coming up on, it's going to be your 3-year anniversary.
Just about, yeah.
Just about. May, yeah. So how are you feeling right now?
I mean, grateful, first and foremost, grateful how everything's played out. It's almost been like clockwork. Like every 6 months, we've tweaked or evolved the restaurant pretty substantially since we've opened. Just because we took over a pre-existing built restaurant, so everything from like the kitchen kind of falling apart and just getting open. So what we've done is like when Olmsted originally opened, it was just a storefront and then a garden in the back. Now, over this like almost 3 years, it's 2 storefronts and 3 gardens in the back. So like we've leased more backspace basically, and like getting used to that, and then adding brunch to that, and now we just opened up a private dining room next door to us. It's just constantly been changing, and I'm kind of excited for it. Like that type of evolution is going to sort of stop now, and we'll just be able to focus on the menu and service.
Is the private dining room have the same name, or is it a sort of a separate concept? Is it just the private dining room for large parties through
Correct.
Olmsted?
Yeah, okay. It's Olmsted is small. So mm-hmm.
It's 50 seats, right?
Yeah. Like fortunately it's very popular, but it's also a very small restaurant, you know? So, it's hard to have a large table. Our biggest table, like uncomfortably sits six people basically, mm-hmm. and wanting to be a restaurant that's in it for the long haul, we wanted to be able to accommodate more parties and rehearsals and weddings and stuff. So, our neighbor, she went out of business. It was a dry cleaner. So we jumped on it.
Before we rewind back to your childhood, which is what we usually do at the start, I do want to talk a little bit about that garden because it's such a magnificent feature of the restaurant. Mm, very lucky that a lot of places that you have that a lot of places don't have, which is this outdoor space, which the restaurant flows quite well into it. I think some restaurants that do have outdoor spaces, it narrows, you walk by the kitchen,
right.
You walk by the bathroom, and then, there's a backyard.
Right.
For those that have never been, that have never seen pictures, can you explain the layout of the restaurant to the garden, and also what have you done in the garden that is a little different than just having
sure.
a backyard patio?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't want what you just described. I didn't want just some tables, some like rickety tables and some lawn furniture outside. So we started, like, once I had been looking to open up a restaurant for a long time, and once I sort of narrowed it down to like a few things, really three things. It was like a small bar, a dining room, but that was, you know, manageable for a small kitchen, but still large enough to be like a profitable restaurant. And then just some type of outside space. And so I didn't want that outside space to just be additional seating because, A, the kitchen is very small, but also because it's not unique. It's not offering anything different. So when we first started building, we started building the garden beds. So there's two sort of big horseshoe-shaped garden beds that take up most of the garden. And from there, then we decided how seating was going to work. So that way it was still substantially a garden for the restaurant and for guests to sort of, I mean, honestly, when we thought about it, when we were opening, we thought maybe people would just walk around, and like, we weren't really sure if we were going to have people eat and drink out there. But once we sort of just played all these like scenarios in our head, okay, so if a guest is told that it's a 20-minute wait and they want to wait outside, obviously you have to let them have something to drink. So then if they're going to drink, if it's taking too long, are they going to sit down on the side of the beds? Yes. Okay, so now we should build little benches attached to the bed. And it just got, because my dad was there building everything, every time we just sort of built a little bit more, we would play out scenarios in our head, and then he would sort of build those adaptations to it.
What's kind of funny about that being sort of like a wonderful mistake almost that you just kind of worked backwards is that most people see square footage and they say, how can I monetize this? How can I pack in 50 tables to the backyard? And you actually went in a different direction. You decided that you started in an aesthetic standpoint almost and said, how can this contribute something to the restaurant? And then you sort of fit your diners, your customers into that new permutation of what a backyard could be.
You know, it has to be a thing. You know, it's too competitive of a market to not be trying, like, not offering something unique, like a bizarre tasting menu or something. But like, you know, I honestly don't like using the word experience because I'm trying to make the restaurant more casual, more approachable.
Sure.
But like, offering a different experience, you mm-hmm. know. That's just, you know, in our case now, it's just having some s'mores outside or a cocktail or some egg rolls. But, you know, it's like for us, we try to grow some stuff. We have some quail. We actually just bought some more quail. So now we have like 16 birds. So we really get like more quail eggs than we need. And, you know, we have a little fish tank with some like a bathtub with some fish in it. And when we clean that tub, we spray all the water over the garden, so that way we're sort of doing like a little mini aquaponics thing and stuff, and we're still trying to figure out how we get a cistern to capture rainwater.
It's cool. So there are some practical applications back there, just beyond it being a feature.
Yeah, honestly, it comes from stuff I like to do, and then we try to just make it cute for the guests. Like, just because I care about this stuff I don't think that the guests have to give a shit about sustainability or whatever, just because I do. Like, they should just be feeling that they're getting something delicious for the money.
Mm-hmm.
And it works out because it's more natural, because it is just like a pretty garden, and you know, now families bring their kids to feed the birds and the fish now on the weekends and
That's
stuff.
Awesome. Let's take it all the way back to kids, to your childhood, to growing up in the southern part of Illinois. Where did you grow up, and what kind of child experience did you have in regards to food? You know, did one or either or any of your parents or grandparents impart any type of love for food on you when you were younger?
So I grew up like about an hour south of Chicago, and we always ate. Like, we always cooked. As soon as I was old enough to cook, I always was sort of into it. It started with popcorn and melting the butter and being fascinated by the butter melting, and then being able to work the grill with my dad. But we always had, you know, Sunday supper but we were also very active. My whole family, my sister is a doctor, and my brother is like he works on all these programmings and stuff. And in high school, we all did sports and had jobs and stuff. So we really were just a very active family. So it wasn't like it just wasn't like a focal point. Like, it was almost just like to keep going a little bit, except for on Sundays when we had like a proper proper meal. But we, I really started to get into it from the Boy Scouts. So like in the Boy Scouts and a lot like in the restaurant world, once you're taught a skill, you're just expected to then do it and no one will help you do that skill anymore. So that, whether that's setting up your tent or being able to carry your own canoe or whatever, start a fire, just once you're checked off the box that you can do it, just an adult will not do it for you anymore. And it's a lot like that in restaurants. Once you've learned a sauce, like then you're now that's your sauce. Now you make that.
Here's your mise en place badge.
Yeah, exactly.
You're on,
I have
you're
my
on your
merit
own.
Badge. So.
You're on your own. Yeah. And so the Boy Scouts, it teaches you a certain level of organization, some precision, just like steps of doing of setting up a tent mirrors things later on in life, which is why Boy Scouts are an effective teaching tool. So you take that from your young age and yeah.
Yeah, well, not to cut you off, but they also, one of those skills is cooking. Mm-hmm. So like once eventually when you're camping, so I really liked it because I would, my brother and my father, we in the Boy Scouts, you go camping once a month. And then in the summer, we would go for like months on end sometimes, like up in Canada. But so like once you're old enough, then your parents don't make the food anymore for you. And you're expected to make it for your little group of friends. And, you know, as you're getting more competitive and older and more competitive, you don't want like your beef stew to be the shitty beef stew that weekend, you know?
Yeah.
And or at least I didn't. And so I just really got into it and I started doing a little Boy Scout cooking competitions at summer camp and stuff. And
when did it really become something that was solidifying in your brain where you thought, maybe this is what I want to do with my life? Because you did end up going to culinary school.
Yeah, yeah,
was
yeah.
there a moment in which you said to your parents in mid-high school, I think that this is what I really was born to do or what I'm going to pursue?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I remember getting Jamie Oliver's first cookbook from my aunt. And like honestly, there's still like one of the first pages is just mirepoix like in a cast iron pot, and I just like was like attracted to that.
Mm-hmm.
So one summer before, so I would like practice, and even then I remember like making a pasta dough in high school. I started making dinner and like setting the table, like operating it like my little restaurant. Like I remember making pasta one time and thinking if I whipped the egg whites for the dough, that would make the pasta dough lighter. And so I just had like this weird thing that I was like cranking through like my little crappy pasta crank machine. And then all the pasta just floated to the top because of all the egg whites to it. I'm pretty sure I still served it. But yeah, sometime towards the end of high school, I did try to get a job at like a country club. My first job really was Wendy's. But then I got into like a country club where we did some basic stuff. And then I did a camp. I did like a cooking camp that ended up being my culinary school a year after that.
So talk a little bit about that. How did you end up? You went in Evanston, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I went to culinary school. It was in Evanston, Illinois. They did move into the city, into Chicago after like a couple of, like after like a year of me being there, they moved the whole school.
And how many years was that program?
I did a two-year one. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. I never was. No one convinced me that the 4-year program was worth it.
Uh-huh.
Not to shit talk about anything, but I don't regret it because I really took culinary school like super seriously. I was the guy watching Emeril on my bed when everyone else was getting drunk, like torneying potatoes and like reading the French Laundry cookbook at the same time, trying to absorb. Like I still have my flashcards from all of my like mother sauces and all the derivatives. Because I just wanted to know them all, you know.
Is it a true story that you got the job at Alinea relative to a research project you were doing for school? Like you sort of backdoored it, right?
It
you went to go observe and then...
Straight naive. I mean...
So tell us about that.
Well, back then there was only e-gullet. That was the only like form of like food internet, at least that's what I remember. Like there wasn't Instagram, there wasn't any of that stuff. And so on eGull, it was like this exciting.
You're really dating yourself. People are like, what is
that
he
was
talking
old,
about?
That was 2005, you know?
It was before the internet.
Basically. I mean, I don't remember looking up restaurants online. So I remember having to buy the cookbook
you
if I wanted.
You couldn't Google recipes. It wasn't a thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of shocking that people still buy cookbooks considering, but.
Totally.
Anyways, go ahead. So you are working on this project.
Yeah. So it's like school's wrapping up and the last thing is like the last class is basically design a restaurant and from scratch sort of a thing. And so I knew I wanted a tasting menu restaurant. I saw all the pictures on eGullet that he was, Grant was like fooling around with at Nick Aconis's house, and he was putting up pictures and stuff, building like anticipation. And so, I called like the week they opened and asked if I could come in and talk to the chef. Like I didn't even know who Chef Atkins was at that time. And so I showed up, and then basically I was just there for a 15-hour stage. And, at the end of it, I was too afraid to ask any questions. They just told me to start doing stuff, and I started doing it. And at the end of it, Chef Atkins came up to me and said, "So what's your deal?" And I was like, I just probably was rambling saying, "Yes, chef." And he said, "Well, do you need to do your internship?" And I was like, "Yes, chef." Although I didn't, I had already done two other ones, one in France and one at a bakery. But I just kind of went with it. And so I switched school to part-time. So that way I can then start my day at Alenia. Then during staff meal, I would go do a class, that 2-hour class, and then I would come back for service. And I did that for just like an arbitrary, like 5-month internship that wasn't equated to anything. And then at the end of that, he offered me a job and was very complimentary of my work ethic. And I remember skipping home at like 3:00 in the morning that day. And I called my mom and woke her up because I was so excited that he actually offered me a job.
Prior to it opening, like when you were reading about him working on the recipes in Nick Aconis's apartment, who's the co-owner of Alenia, and they've obviously gone on to do amazing things there. Did everyone know? Like, were people talking about, there's this guy, Grant Atkins, he's doing things that are like off the wall and this is going to be the next thing? Or did you kind of see it before it was materializing?
For me, I don't think I...
What attracted
I
you
wanted,
to it?
That's what I thought it was going to be like everywhere I went. What I loved was I was in a room full of people that all were as passionate about what they did as equally as I did. Mm-hmm. And people from around the world would come and stage, and I'm still friends with people that I met for 3 days that came to Alenia because we're just like-minded people. It's like when I went to, when I moved to Spain to work at Muguritz, like, I was living in an apartment building with a 3-bedroom apartment with like 4 sets of bunk beds in each room, and 20 of us were just crammed in there living. And like, you can't have that experience and not be like a wiser and more worldly, open-minded human after none of us even lived in the same country.
And I mean, you spend a couple days, 15-hour days with people. You get tight real quick. It pushes everyone to the limits quite a lot. I want to ask you more questions about Alenia, but I also want to ask you about those other overseas trips. So mm-hmm. you were a little out of order, but you were at Muguritz. You were in Norway.
Yep.
And you were also at a bakery.
Okay. So my background
is... Do this timeline for us. Set us up.
After Wendy's, we'll start at Alenia. So I worked at Alenia for almost the first 4 years that it was open. Mm-hmm. And I cannot say enough good things about my experience there. Chef Atkins is still like very much a part of, I reach out to him every time I need advice. But I mean, when I put in my notice, I honestly said, I don't know if our trash cans are the cleanest trash cans or if like our ice cream is the best ice cream. I don't have anything to compare it to. I've just been here for the last 4 years. Mm-hmm. And so he agreed that it was time for me to go. And he helped me set up basically about 6 months in Spain, where I did like a week or so at El Bulli, a week or so at Arzak, and then 3 months at Muguritz. And then from there, I moved to New York to work at Per Se for, I planned on working at Per Se for years. But while I was there, again, Chef Atkins, after about me being there for about a year and a half or so at Per Se, he was eating at Blue Out Stone Barns and my name came up. So Dan Barber reached out and offered me the chef position. And so I did that for 2 years. Then I moved, then I helped open up North End Grill and Atera for about 6 months and 6 months. And then, because I wanted to see a Danny Meyer operation, mm-hmm. and And so I know Matt was one of the, Matt Leitner from Matera, he was one of the only Americans at Mugeriets at the time, so we met there. And then I moved to Norway for about 6 months, 5 months. And then I personal chefed for the Seinfelds for about 2 years.
Right. And so, cool, now that we've established that timeline, let's go back to Grant Achatz and ask about that Alinea kitchen. For those of us that will never be, you know, fortunate enough to eat there and walk through that kitchen, what is that like being there for 4 years amongst all that creativity? And also just the pursuit of excellence there is really nearly unmatched. There's a couple other places mm-hmm. that can play in that same level, but you were there for 4 years. Tell us what it's like to be in that proximity to what they do at Alinea and what you did there with them.
I mean, on top of that, it was also its first 4 years, you know? And right. So like, not that it's, you know, diminished at all, but when I was there with Jordan Kahn of Vespertine, Alex Dupak of Empayon, Curtis Duffy, John Shields, Josh from Best Day. Like, everybody I worked with now has a very successful restaurant somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that happens to, like, the French Laundry in its first 5 years. And, like, it's, and I'm sure the people now that are at Alinea will go off and do amazing things, too. But, like, back then there was only, like, 12 of us total, counting Grant and the sous chefs. Now there's, like, 20-something. So it was, like, new, and Grant was very protective of it. And it was even more intimate because there was just even fewer of us. And, like, it used to be so quiet that, like, you could hear the fan running on the inductions, like, across the room, because you just didn't talk unless you had to. I remember Grant one time was so sick of, 15 people saying behind all the time that we stopped saying behind, and you were just expected to know where everyone was. And if you were walking past someone, you just brushed their, like, with the back of your, you brushed your back, their back with the back of your finger. Like, awareness was super, super high, you know?
That is actually, to people who just work in, let's just call them normal kitchens, for lack of a better term,
yeah.
That seems so insane, since one of the first things that you hear in a kitchen is communicate. Like, tell me where you're at on this dish. Where are you at on prep? Like, do you need assistance? Like, did that produce order come in? It's all like talking. And yet what you're saying now is that you just had to be playing at a higher level. You had to be functioning at a different sort of plane of existence. Who was in that kitchen?
Who was around you? You know, if we were low on something, you just, the expectation was so high. And what was like awesome for me was, so like when I started there, I was a free intern, and like a week into it, I was the lowest of the low. There were three interns, and I was the last one that was hired, and I was on cold garmager, and the guy quit. The guy said this wasn't for me, even though he worked at Trio and everything. Just too much. And so Grant came up to me and was like, either I hire someone or you run with the opportunity. And so that was like my first in. And then after I worked at station for a while, I got moved over to like assisting the meat station and then working the meat station. And pretty much every section has their own chef or sous chef that they pass all their mise en place to. Like, you just cook if you're the cook, and then the sous chefs plate everything. At least that's how it was back then. And for like a huge chunk of that time, the person I passed everything to was Grant. So like, if it wasn't perfect, like, I could tell by the way he held his spoon, by the way he tapped on the pass, the way he would lean, like I could just read him like a book, to where like if I put something there, like just how if he blinked a certain way, I would just take it back and throw it away and do it again. Like,
it sounds brutal, but it sounds like a good training ground to what comes next.
Yeah, but it was brutal, but like he's not the type of guy that like creates, like there are chefs that create chaos because they like that type of environment. Mm-hmm. For him, it's just like the expectation is high, and it's consistent. Like, a lot of chefs like, they like the energy of a chaotic kitchen. They still want the food to be great and everything, but they sort of like to stir the pot. They like to cause, you know, people to argue, and they like to, you know, fuck with people basically. And, you know, Grant wasn't like that. It was like, it's nice to be able to lean on, like, he just wants it to be perfect, and like, none of it's personal, you know? And so if he's telling you it's wrong, it's just wrong.
Before we take a break, I want to ask you about another chef who's in pursuit of perfection that you worked for, Dan Barber.
Yep.
Talk a little bit about Chef Barber. You can obviously speak to them as being very different people, but one of the fundamental differences from my very outside perspective, having never had the ability to eat at each restaurant, is that I don't think Dan Barber would ever serve a balloon that has flavor inside of it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if Grant Achatz would ever just put a singular carrot down on the table that's right. been just roasted.
Right, right, right.
Does that feel correct to you in some sort of way?
Honestly, that was like the draw to it. Like, I loved per se, but, you know, I knew how to act it. I knew how to excel at per se because Grant came from Thomas Keller. And so although the food is very different, the mindset and everything else was very much the same. And so when the opportunity to work for Dan Barber came up, I jumped at it because it's not that per se and Alenia don't source amazing sustainable products and everything. It's just that like he just came from a Boulet. Like Boulet has his own proteges, Cesar Ramirez and everybody else, you know? So, like to be able to, like, I remember Dan Barber once coming up to me, and like talking about his Hakurai turnips, like Eli at per se would talk about the caviar, like just like such passion for a freaking turnip, you know? And so I really, you know, in the beginning I really struggled because, you know, I just came from like a very regimented background. Like I remember Dan, you know, rightfully so, told me, he was like, look, I'm afraid to take a week off because you'll have this place run like a military by the time I get back. You know, in hindsight, I didn't appreciate it as much while I was there. I really just was like, my role is to create order and consistency. So I did not walk around the farm as much as I probably should have and engaged with the farmers and stuff. Like I just was like, this is my post and this is what I'm supposed to be doing.
Like it's not, the kitchen, this isn't romantic. The kitchen was your room.
Yeah. Like for me, in all of my jobs, like I never tried to give Dan a dish that I had been working on or Grant or anybody. Like for me, it was like for me to excel at my current job is to like to think like Grant and give him what he needs or wants. So like if he liked certain ingredients and certain things, then I would like propose those things. I didn't like, well, this is what I think, you know, like mm-hmm. I don't feel like that's what I was getting paid for. I'm not getting paid to like change Blue Hill at Stone Barns. I'm there to assist Dan Barber. And, I don't know. I still think that.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to actually start talking about you and a couple dishes that you've created.
Okay.
We'll be right back. Stick with us.
This episode is brought to you by Heritage Foods. Heritage Foods was founded to sell ancient breeds of livestock and poultry that were becoming extinct, largely because industrial agriculture willfully pushed healthy heritage breeds aside for more profitable, faster-growing animals. Rare heritage breeds are saved when popular demand increases and farmers have the incentive to raise them. This Thanksgiving, we encourage you to buy a turkey from Frank Reese's Good Shepherd Poultry Ranch. Frank's turkeys are 100% purebred heritage, 100% pasture-raised, and 100% antibiotic-free. Turkeys are available in 2-pound increments. You choose your size. Don't wait. Pre-order your Heritage Thanksgiving turkey today at heritagefoods.com. Next time you step up for the intention, remember most the great distinction.
Between Welcome back to The Line here on Heritage Radio. I'm joined today by Chef Greg Backstrom, the owner and chef of Olmsted, located in Prospect Heights. It opened in 2016 to critical acclaim, and they've been really moving ever since, garnering lots of wonderful awards. But before we start talking about Olmsted, before the break, we were talking about two chefs that had a lot of impact on him. And Greg, you said that at both of those restaurants, working for Grant Achatz at Alinea, working for Dan Barber, that you never felt that it was your role to really innovate new dishes. You were there to kind of execute their vision. When did you start to really feel like you had something that you wanted to say independent of those restaurants? When did the idea come into form to work on opening your own place?
I mean, like, even when I was a line cook at Alinea, like, the goal was, even at Wendy's, like, the goal was always to open up my own restaurant.
Yeah.
After Stone Barns and honestly, when I was at my friend's restaurant in Norway, you know, he had like some weird cooking equipment. Sorry, Chris, but he had like a weird Chinese flat top stove, and it was really crummy. And he has since like remodeled his whole kitchen, and it's gorgeous. But I don't know. There was a point where it clicked, and I was like, okay, well, you know how to cook. So what do you do now? And like, that was a big part of why I left Blue Hill at Stone Barns, was because, you know, like, when you're working all these hours, even, you know, you need investors, you need people with money basically to have confidence in you. And although a lot of these people have money that are dining at these restaurants, you're not interacting with them. So
they don't necessarily even know who you are. Yeah, really. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, at some point you have to just step out of that. And so that's what I did. And that's when I started to like bounce around a lot, and then doing the personal chefing thing, because then I could cook for more people. I could meet more people, do tastings and that kind of stuff.
Was the private chef gig, how did that come to be? And from a financial standpoint, was that also about you doing some fundraising on your own? Like, look, I'll save up a little bit of money, or was it really more for the networking?
I mean, you would have to do it for years and years to really put a dent into being able to help pay for your own restaurant, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it came to where, like, I didn't have... Basically, I did a dinner for the Seinfelds, and they reached out after I did it, and they were like, look, we could get whatever... You know, you can get a job wherever you... with your resume, and we can hire anyone we want. You know, why don't... we'll just not put a time... There's no time commitment, and we'll just keep it open and honest. And I just stuck around for 2 years.
And so did you do a lot of large-scale private dinners for them, or were you mostly cooking just for them in their home?
Both. I mean, I would, you know, I would cook for them, for their family. They have three kids, and they like Marvel comics and stuff, so we got along pretty well.
Uh-huh.
And then they would have, you know, they would enter to me, you know, so then they would sort of keep it casual and simple for those meals, and then, you know, they would let me do my thing when they would invite friends over.
And so how did you end up fundraising for the restaurant? You obviously, you had a network,
yep.
You had chefs that you worked for,
yep.
You had the resume. Mm-hmm. When you really just drill down into it, did you put a deck together? Did you do tasting dinners that had any dishes that remotely resemble Olmsted? Like, how did you actually go out there and get it done?
I mean, honestly, it fell through like 20 times. Like, I almost did something with the Nakazawa guy, and all these different people, and doing a tasting, and like in those tastings, you're sort of, or I was at least, like catering to them a little bit and to like the space that they had found already. So like, if it looked more fine dining, then I was like, okay, well, let's do a tasting menu restaurant here, and you know, et cetera. But so when it came down to Olmsted, basically these people reached out through LinkedIn needing a consultant because the restaurant wasn't doing well. And again, I had. Like, one of the first things you have to do once you're not in a kitchen anymore is you have to hire a lawyer, basically. And otherwise, you just keep making the same mistake like I did. And it took a long time for me to eventually realize that. But, like, you need guidance as to, like, what is your worth? What do you ask for? Like, I have that with the chefs and stuff, like with Chef Achatz and Dan Barber and them. But eventually, you need, like, paid legal advice. So by the time I got to Olmsted... I met these really lovely people. Their restaurant wasn't working out. They wanted me to just to fix it, and then like in our first meeting, they were just like, "Well, what if we just start over?" And at that point, I had done that conversation enough times where I was just like, "Well, this is what I would need, and it would just be total control of this, you know, about 50% of that. This is what I want. I want control over these things." And they were like, "Okay, well, let's do a tasting, and if it goes well, then we're on board." And that's what I did.
So do you have pretty much the final say on everything at this point with Olmsted?
Yeah.
So are you now the sole proprietor of the restaurant?
Well, we have investors, and I have two partners. Mm-hmm. One of them is Max, the general manager, and mm-hmm. he's now a partner in the restaurant. And then we have some small investors and whatnot. But yeah, I mean, fortunately, I have so many chef friends that like think that they're their owner, or think that they're the chef, or their partners tell them that they're the chef owner, and there's nothing on paper. You know, like I made sure that
you were protected.
Yeah.
How would you describe Olmsted as a restaurant? It has been described in many different permutations with often the word neighborhood involved way. How would you describe Olmsted?
Well, that was my idea. And it's funny when people ask like me to elaborate on that, and then I really don't know what to say. Here's an actual tangent side joke. So we got prank called once, and the kid was asking like, "So what kind of food do you serve there, blah, 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 and what kind of restaurant it?" And they said, whoever picked up the phone replied with, I think it was Catherine, "You know, we're a neighborhood restaurant." And the kid was just like, "What the hell does that even mean?" And from that moment, I kind of stopped using it.
Uh-huh.
But honestly, it's just like another word for approachable is what I mean. The best description I've ever received was, and I don't remember who told me this, but it's if Alenia and Blue House Stone Barn had a casual baby. Like, I think that really sums up what we're trying to do. Like, the food is playful, inventive. Hopefully people think that. And delicious.
I think that's a great way of putting it, because it seems to be a distillation of a lot of things that you've taken from various places, and you've taken flavors and plating, and everyone knows that you could have done a $275 tasting menu. Mm. To me, that seems like it could have been an obvious direction for you based on your resume, but you don't have anything on the menu that's more than $24,
right,
which is, I think that's surprising to people that a restaurant in New York that's run by a chef who has worked at these places opens up a spot and says, "Yeah, no entrees above $24." Was that why is that?
Yeah.
And as things get more expensive and labor goes up and everything like that, like, is there a time when Olmsted might have a $38 X on the menu, or do you just not want to go in that direction?
No, I mean, I'm not going to jeopardize. We have 50 employees now. If we get to a point where things become more expensive, then of course we're not going to just start tripling our prices or something like that.
But right.
Like we are a tiny neighborhood restaurant that should probably have like 12 employees, but we have 50.
And why do you have 50 employees?
Because although like the music is loud and it's crowded and whatnot, there's usually like 5 to 7 people on the floor for that tiny restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
There's 2 people behind the bar, and we want to use nice plates, and we want the service. Although there's not like some psalm standing down, you know, making you feel like you don't know what you're talking about. We still have great wine service.
You have a wine director.
Yeah. I mean, we just brought on a pastry chef. And like that is because some of these things we're trying to build a stronger foundation so we can build another restaurant and maybe a bakery someday and yada, yada, yada. But like, man, I just want it to be good. And so as long as we can stay busy and keep hopefully exceeding people's expectations, then the prices aren't going to go up, you know?
Can you talk?
Because we're busy. And so that fixes that problem, you know? Like, I don't want to be, I don't want to have a fucking expensive tasting menu restaurant and get my 2 Michelin stars and close it 3 or 4 years into it. Like, I would hate that. Mm-hmm. Like, I would much rather have what I have right now.
Can you take us through the conceptualization of dishes? You have a lot of flavor profiles going on. I think what's really cool about the restaurant is that even though we did just kind of unfortunately categorize it and box it in as a neighborhood restaurant, it does defy that based on the flavors that hit your table. You have pierogies, spetzel, crepes. I have seen Thai-inspired dishes. I've seen Chinese-inspired dishes.
Yeah.
Where do you start from, and then how does it end up becoming a dish that makes it on the menu?
Basically, like, so, like, I need to work into a box. Although the menu does not seem like it's in a box, everything is coming from the farmer's market. Like, if we're not growing it in the garden or, like, getting it sourced from Montauk, you know, it's coming from Union Square Farmers Market, if not, or Grand Army Plaza. And so even if it's Thai-inspired or Chinese or pierogies, like, the pierogies are sweet potatoes that we buy from the farmers market, and we want to still find ways to use luxury ingredients. So uni. So it's Maine uni, but a tray of uni is $50. But if you buy the ones that are that get broken when they're being shucked, because these people are shucking a ton of them and they don't all come out perfect, it's half. It's $25. So how can I serve sea urchin in a restaurant? Even the $25 one, I would still have to charge too much for it. Like, it would be like either like something that's a one biter that is expensive still, that doesn't equate to like our pricing structure, or I turn that into a filling and put it into something nice. So we make like a really, one of our cooks had a really amazing pierogi dough recipe. So we made it and we fooled around with a couple of different fillings. And so now we have uni sweet potato pierogies. Like, a classic combo is butternut squash and uni for pasta. A lot of chefs like to do that. John George and Dan Barber both like that combo. And, you know, with pierogies being potatoes, it just was sort of like a natural fit. And then on top of that, we still make them. We make at least like 10 orders without any of the uni, so that way a guest can still order just a vegetarian pierogi if they want to. So like, we tried like this carrot crepe thing that we make, like, you could get that vegetarian, gluten-free, or regular. Like, we really try to accommodate everything as much as we possibly can.
Do you do that because of, is that your personal desire to be open like that? Or do you just feel like because of the vibe of the restaurant that you want all those permutations so that people can come in and they can make a meal however they see fit?
Yeah, I mean, I just want people to be comfortable and like it, you know? And so if that, like, yes, it's annoying to like put something on the menu and then the next day like have to have like, okay, oh yeah, well, we should have had a vegetarian version of that and we should have done this. And like, if someone doesn't want seafood but we can make something delicious with the same flavor profile, it's not that big of an inconvenience, you know? And I'm just not that guy that's like, this is my creation, you have to eat it this way. Like, it's still food. And they're still giving me their money. So like, again, it just seems like the more you try to cater to the guests and not yourself, the busier the restaurant is. And then the more, like, at the end of the day, I still get to put whatever the hell I want on the menu. There still is some weird crab rangoon thing and some sushi thing and some pasta that's not pasta and a pork dish that's, you know, so.
Well, you say it because it's the way you feel and it's obvious, but a lot of chefs just don't go in that direction. They go in the exact opposite direction. And so as a chef and the owner, you are also, you know, there is the creativity, there is the hospitality, but there's also like the bottom line. Yeah. So how much right now time, how are you dividing your time between things that are directly correlated to service, hospitality, food creation, and how much of your time do you spend doing all that other stuff, sitting at a computer, pricing guides, documentation, things like that?
Well, I have to tell you, I got it pretty good because my partner, Max, we met at Stone Barns. So I have two primary partners, Mike Kennedy and Max Katzenberg. And Max and I met when he was a captain at Blue Hill at Stone Barns. And I don't know, we always sort of just stayed in touch after we moved on. And he oversees service, the front of the house end of service. But because there's also a wine director and like a and bar and stuff like that, like it doesn't force him to spend all of his time there. And then so he's able to deal with all that kind of stuff, with all the stuff I don't want to do, basically. So I'm very grateful for that for him.
Can you talk
it
about...
It keeps my job super romantic. I mean, I still work all the time. We're going to open up another restaurant next year.
But
I still get to do...
You're still in the kitchen. People still see you expoing. I've seen people are like, the chef is here. It's like, yeah, it's his restaurant.
Well, I used to live across the street. I moved like a few blocks further away just to have some...
Good way to create some separation for yourself.
Yeah, it was getting a little awkward when I would like buy a frozen pizza and like my sous chef would be in the next line like buying chives or something like that, you know, and yeah. I was like trying not to come in that day.
It was your day off and you were just going to go home.
You
and,
know,
like,
I have like a 6-pack of Stella and a cheap frozen pizza.
Can you talk about the new restaurant at all? What might it be like? What are you trying to do with the new space?
I can't really go into it too much just because it's a little too far out. Mm-hmm. But basically, someday I do want to do fine dining again. Mm-hmm. But I want to, you know, I want a foundation, you know, before, so that way I can, like I said, that's why we have a pastry chef now and why we're, you know, when we opened, we only had 60 bottles of wine under like $60 or something like that. And now we're at like 150 or something. But the new restaurant is going to be another stab at even more approachable with a lot of French influence. But I want it to be even more affordable than Olmsted.
Even so, the price point will be lower.
Yeah. And then, you know, after we've done that and hopefully a bakery sometime in the next like 16 months, 18 months, then I would hope, you know, don't quote me on that, but like to try to do a fine dining restaurant.
So at a lower price point, how do you achieve that?
I got a whole plan for it that I'm not ready to announce
that you're
yet.
Not ready to share. Yeah.
Yeah, but I really think, I really do think it'll work and it's going to be like, I still get to get the same great scallops that we use and serve them in this price point in this like idea that I basically, I think it's a little bit of a weird thing that doesn't exist. So,
okay. Well, look, when you are ready to talk about it, come back and we'll talk about it.
For sure.
It sounds like it's a whole new concept that diverges from both fine dining and from Olmsted to a certain degree.
Like the idea, like I won't be able to work. I won't at least, I mean, maybe 20 years from now you can, if I'm trying to sell out and make more money or something, but at this point I don't really care about money. So I want another restaurant to in it. Like, Olmsted is still a thing for some people. Like it's still an event. It's like, it's a 2-month waiting list. It's it's a little obnoxious in my opinion. And so, you know, I want the next one to not feel that way. Like I want it to be a little bit more, let's just go. Like Roberta's, you know, I want it to be a little bit more like, hey, let's just go.
When you come into the restaurant now and you've got a couple years under your belt, what are the things that make you the most excited about coming to work every single day and are still fueling you? And is there one or two things that are on your chef owner list that you are still scared and worried about?
Well, I'll start with the second one. That like still staffing is still like the hardest thing by far. Like I don't know if it's generational or whatever. You know, I'm not gonna shit talk a generation people, you know. But for me it just never has been and it probably never will be about salary or time. Like I just knew that I wanted to be a chef, and then I knew that, well, if I'm not the strongest one in the kitchen that I'm working at that time, then how will I ever meet my goals? And like that's just like how I approached the last 15 years, basically. And I can't even say that is the right way to do it because, you know, relationships fall to the side. I've been, you know, I used to be married. And so like, I can't really advocate that other people should do that. But career wise, at least I have what I was shooting for though, you know? Mm-hmm. And honestly, I just love, I just love the restaurant. Like, I really do, like, even if I take a day off, I still find myself wandering around in the garden or something. I love taking friends from out of town, you know, that haven't seen it yet, and showing them. I like playing around when the menu changes so often that there's a really nice balance, in my opinion, of like dishes that we keep bringing back. Like the pierogies change out for the crab rangoon, and then there are, you know, because it's like a grid. We have a grid of, okay, it's a there's three sections plus desserts, so there's five items in each section, right? And so in it there's one meat, two veg, two seafood, and like that way we're just accommodating more people again. Like it's so that way it's intentional that like a pescatarian can easily eat here. And so I like that there's like, it's a little bit less daunting looking at the menu, having to completely change it again, because we have the rutabaga pasta comes back. And so that's a little less pressure, but so now I can focus on the new pork dish or something. That's starting to become, a lot nicer. It doesn't feel so much like I'm sprinting anymore. You know, I feel more in control.
Let's talk about that control and leadership style and leading a kitchen. You've obviously led other kitchens before. Mm-hmm. Is running and leading Olmsted, is it more freeing of an experience than your previous kitchen leadership positions, or is it actually more difficult from the position of being the one at the top?
It's more difficult. I mean, it's for the same... it's more difficult because in the other restaurants, it was just black and white, everything. And, you know, that's not how I want to be. Like I was such an asshole as the chef at Stone Barns. Like, and I don't scream or yell. Of course, when the restaurant opened, I was like super, insane, but, I really don't try to yell. I really, I'm not the best communicator, and I'm trying to get better at that. And on top of that, like, I don't want the culture just to come from me, because my culture is less relatable. And so giving the opportunity for the sous chefs and the other management, for them to kind of sort of be taught by me on how, like, what the expectations are, and then them become leaders. Because, I don't know, I found this myself every time a cook would quit or something, our old chef de cuisine, like I would just put her back on the line, and then she would just be a line cook again until we fixed the problem. And like that financially makes the most sense, and you know, everything, but it was hard for her to then like have an authority of like, this is my post, do what I say, if like every 10 weeks she got put back on the line. And so it's a learning curve. It really is like, you know, I don't just scream and say, why the fuck did you do this? Throw this away. That guy's going to quit, and then it's going to fuck up my food cost, you know? So like, again, like it's finding a balance of, being more human and being responsible for my business. And trying to figure out what people want now. When we opened, all the cooks had to work like 70 hours a week. And this is not something to brag about. Like, honestly, like every 12 weeks for the first 2 years we were open, someone quit. Like, it was a nightmare. Didn't matter that Chef Atkins was coming in. We were getting all this. It was just too much work. And it had nothing to do with pay. We pay great. But eventually, I refused to change it. I wanted it to be that way. I wanted it to be the restaurant that paid well. And let's all dedicate our lives to this. And once we've switched to 50 hours a week, everyone stopped quitting. Like it really was about the amount of labor, like about the hours. And now it's like, it's substantially healthier, and we have more support in like the morning team. You know, before we opened, we had like four, me and three other cooks. Now there's like 10 or 12 of us.
It's obviously, that's one of the most important things, to try to find that balance there. Yeah. And growing and learning as things go on. I'm excited to hear about the new project. Whenever you can, yeah, come back, we want to hear about it. And for the time being, where can people find you at Olmsted? Please give us the address and when you're open.
Yeah, we're open. So Olmsted is a 7-day-a-week restaurant. We still the the per se schedule. So we do lunch Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then dinner every day of the week. And then we just opened up this new PDR, and it's my dad built it himself. It's super pretty. So definitely come by and check it out.
What's the address?
659 Vanderbilt Avenue.
Cool. Chef, thanks so much for being here and talking more about your story and how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, man. Thanks for letting me ramble around.
Join us here every week, Tuesdays at 11 a.m. for new episodes of The Line on Heritage Radio.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.